something outside.
What is that?
Radio.
Welcome, Exorcists. This is Gunnar with Monster X Radio. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. I don't know if any of you know this, but I actually wrote the arrangement and played all the instruments myself in the intro. I'm just kidding. I did not. That was actually put together by our co-host, Shane Corson.
Yay.
Again, with me today, we're excited today because we're having the live Q&A. We haven't done one of these in quite some time, and we hope to have answered questions from folks that have joined us and calling in. With me today are Julie Wrench and Shane Corson. How are you guys today?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, doing good, Gunnar. Briefly before the show started, we were talking about weather, and I just want to say the weather up here in the Pacific Northwest, specifically Washington, has been a little bit crazy. We've had all sorts of hail and thunder and whatnot. It's a funny time to be out researching, and to steal a line from Forrest Gump with my own input, the weather in the Pacific Northwest is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get, and I'll tell you what, it's exactly like that. It's been nuts, but I'm still getting out there doing some research and recording. I know we've had friends in the field recently down in the Tillamook area doing some great research down there with some interesting results that hopefully down the road on one of these shows we can have that, you know, that individual on and talk about what's going on down there in the Tillamook Forest. But, man, I don't know about you guys, but the weather up here has been nuts.
It's been, it's spring, almost summer, and we pretty much count on rain right up through the 4th of July on the Oregon coast. But it's actually been pretty nice so far, just getting a little rain, watering the grass. Gives us an opportunity to get out there and mow, which, you know, we all love to do. How are things over in your neck of the woods, Julie?
Oh, well, let's see. It's been like 85 degrees and very humid. We're still over at the beach, so it's going to be expected, you know. But not much rain last couple of days. It's looking to be a good week overall. It's been pretty good weather here. We went from winter to summer.
Yeah. Sometimes you just skip seasons in certain parts of the country. And I think they only have two seasons back there, so.
Right.
So let's go ahead and see who we've got on. I see that we've got a caller. Let's go ahead and check them out.
Okay. Let's see here. Let me go ahead and okay, caller, you are live. Who are we speaking with?
I think you're speaking to Larry, I think.
Larry?
Larry.
Hey, Larry.
It's me, yeah. Hey.
Larry, what's going on?
Just a quick note on the weather. I saw it all last night. Sideways rain. Actually, the whole campground was a swamp when I came out of my tent this morning. It was fun. And I was out last night. And I just got home. Well, I'm not even home. I'm still in my mobile office at large. And I got a question.
Yes.
That being, and this is, I'm winging this now, but I got a question. And that is, in the Bigfoot world, I hear a lot about conservation and protecting the species as a whole. both, this question is for both Shane and Gunner. What would that mean to you in the way of conservation and protection of the species as it's not really been identified yet, but if it comes to fruition where it is, what would it mean to you? And do you agree with conservation and protecting, say, the lands in which they live on, that type of thing? Just throwing some ideas out there, but I'd like to know your thoughts on that.
Shane, why don't you take that first, and then I'll follow up.
Yeah. Larry, it's a great question, tough one to answer, to be honest with you, because like you said, Sasquatch hasn't been proven, but if it ever were proven, yeah, it would shake up a lot of, it would not only create a lot of talk, but then, you know, you have to at some point further the research of this known entity, this known creature out in the woods of North America, and you'd probably have to set aside land. But by doing that, you're going to have to really do a lot of research on Sasquatch itself. And that's where I think researchers and those individuals like Dr. Jeff Meldrum and some of these science-based individuals that are involved with this research come into play, because science is going to go, okay, now this creature, this you know, Sasquatch does exist. Now, they're going to lean on us for information on all of our, you know, collaborative efforts, everything we've documented, and then, you know, and expand upon that. You know, science is now going to be heavily interested as a whole, wondering how Sasquatch could exist without being, you know, why haven't we discovered bodies? You know, and they're going to want to know, well, how do they live? How do they thrive? How do they breed? What do they eat? It's going to create a bit of a storm in that. And so everything's going to be affected. Logging, people out camping. So there would have to be, I would imagine, and just me spitballing here, but I would imagine you're going to have to set aside lands, extreme. So we don't know how much land a Sasquatch needs to survive and thrive. So you're going to have to set aside specific amounts of land designated for Sasquatch. But, I mean, that's all that is. Even when Sasquatch proven exists, that can't happen overnight. It's going to take study of Sasquatch in their environment, which we already know is near impossible because we haven't proven them to exist yet. But it's going to take a lot of science and individuals that will become interested in it because of it being proven to get an answer there. But it's going to affect everything as we know, whether it's camping or logging. It's a really tough question to answer, but I'm all for it. I'll tell you, I'll be all for it because I know Sasquatch exists. And I'm of the opinion that perhaps they do need some sort of protection. You know, I'm not saying they're not doing well on their own. I'm not saying that, but we don't know. We don't know. Maybe because of our encroachment as a species, as humans, growing and populating and taking over more and more land, we're making their environment smaller and smaller. All these wildfires happening, destroying, you know, old growth forests and whatnot. If you look at the orangutans, like in Sumatra and some other areas where deforestation and fires take place, these orangutans are hurting. They're hurting big time, and it's not even a question. They're becoming they could be on the very much on the endangered list, and so Sasquatch could be already there. We don't know. We don't know. Maybe they're doing just fine, but that's something that science is going to have to look at, that conservationists are going to have to look at, the government's going to have to look at. And I know, unfortunately, as soon as you get the government involved, usually that's a bad thing and everything goes downhill. But that's a question that I hope is raised, because we don't know if Sasquatch, I sure as heck don't know if Sasquatch is doing great, they're doing bad, but great question. I mean, I don't have a solid answer other than I know that when that day comes, and I think it will come, it's going to be detrimental to their species, that we maybe possibly look at some sort of heavy conservation in these forests around North America.
My opinion is basically we should already be protecting the environment that Sasquatch shares with all the known animals. So that looks like, and you know, at discovery, when there's a humanoid or a closer to human species, a mammal, you know, a primate. I'm not sure what the outcome will be. I mean, there, you know, you've heard the stories of the logging industry being concerned that there's, I've heard stories of, you know, it's kind of a, don't talk about it. If you have a Bigfoot sighting, don't talk about it because they'll shut the logging industry down. I don't see that happening. I think there would be a time of assessment where the government would have to assess their population and territory needs and all that kind of stuff. But I'm of the opinion that we should already be conserving our forests, as you know, managing them in an intelligent way. Because my thing is, we're stewards of the planet. I would like my grandchildren to be able to walk out in the woods. So it's an important part of our ecology, and there will be some moment of pause and a period of assessment. Julie, do you have some input in that?
Yeah, I was sitting here thinking about that, and like, for example, where I'm at, the different recordings I've been getting and the things that have been going on around our property, these things are on other people's private property. So it's really got me thinking, if they do, you know, deem them to exist, what about the ones that are hanging out on people's private property? I mean, how are they going to tell them what to do with them on their own private property? They're going to have to set up really strange laws because, you know, the gorillas, for example, they have the forest that it's not really private property. So that applies to wherever they go in the forest. Well, here in the States, you have them on people's property. So I always, how do you handle that, you know? Because the people around where I live, they don't take too kindly to anybody telling them what to do about anything that's on their property. So I think that could open up a really huge can of worms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting thought, Julie. Interesting thought, you know, and I don't think there's an easy answer there, you know. So,
no.
Yeah, that's something that we'll have to see played out if Sasquatch has ever proven to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Larry, does that kind of answer your question, Larry?
Yeah, I don't know if we've ever spoke about that before, but one thing's for certain, in our experiences, you don't really have to go look for them. They come to you, for one thing. We can't control them. That's a given. And they are on private property. My feelings on that is that most definitely would be much more an impact than the spotted owl has here on the north in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
You think?
I'm bringing this up for a point. Is that there was much study on the spotted owl that they only lived in old growth forests. Well, Oregon only had like less than 10% old growth forests. And I've seen with my own eyes while hunting reef rot, spotted owls, you know, catching mice and stuff. So, and they closed out vast tracts of national forest when to protect these species when they easily adapted. And with the spotted owl far-reaching consequences, we've lost vast tracts of access to timberlands. In Oregon, I don't know if any of you guys realize that, but the populated area of Oregon is only 3% of the landmass of the entire state. Therefore, all the rest of that is unpopulated. I did my study. So with that, the encroachment in their environment, we've seen logging, and that's all planned. And, you know, it's a state law and a federal law to replant inside of 2 years. And for everybody that's listening out there, trees grow like grass in Oregon. Within 5 years, those trees are 15 feet tall. They just grow that fast. So I'm just kind of trying to wrap this around in my head, looking forward, forward thinking, because the government will do a knee-jerk reaction like they did with the spotted owl, mm-hmm. close up vast mm-hmm. tracts of land. I wanted to have your opinions on that. I certainly have an opinion on it. But these, in my opinion, from what I've seen, is that, with the contacts that I've had, one thing's for sure, like I told you, we don't have to go look for them. Most of the time, if they're in the area, they'll find you, or they're on private property and stuff.
Right.
The conservation, that part there I wanted to throw at you guys, because these things here have been doing quite well. I mean, we've been in areas where motorcycles are ripping around all over the place, guns going off all over the place, and there they are. We can't figure it out. That's why I wanted to ask you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. Yeah, real quick, Larry. I mean, those areas that you speak of that we've researched in, first of all, I'm not going to claim to know what Sasquatch is doing or, I think Sasquatch is mainly – a nocturnal thing where, they do a lot of their stuff at night. But is that because of man, or is that something that's natural for them in general? And are they just passing through these areas where they're, people are at, or are they trying to actually live in an area where people are at? So many questions. The government, nobody, I believe, really knows the answer. I don't know the answer. And so it's a tough question. There'll have to be a huge freaking study. What will happen. It'll probably be, like you said, and a great point, a knee-jerk reaction from the government, and from the public, where people are going to be, I've been out camping in that area, and there was Sasquatch there, they were there, so there's going to be a lot of knee-jerk reactions, but nobody, I think, can claim to know exactly what's good for a Sasquatch. Yeah, I think they're doing good. I think they're doing fine, but I mean, I don't know that for a fact, that I don't know if old growth forests play are an impact in their life, or if that even matters, So there's just a lot of questions there that need answering. I don't think there's an easy answer for it, but I guarantee that it will shake up science, will shake up everything as we know it, if that day comes, which I think it will. And, we'll have to see where the cards fall there. But, for a fact that, I'm big into conservation, whether I'm hiking or whatnot. I'm hugely into conservation, like Gunnar said. It's something we should be doing, something that we are, I know, as individuals are doing, something we promote regardless of the Sasquatch phenomena, because there's a lot of other species out there that need protection and need the environment, in a clean manner. And, it's something we should be doing already, like Gunnar mentioned.
No, what I foresee happening is that I've got about 200 of these signs that say, do not feed the Sasquatch, and I will put those to the government immediately. People need to be aware that they're sharing the forest with these monsters. So, no, I'm just kidding. But how much protection do they need? Because, I've heard the conversation, people bring it up, that when they're discovered, that people will start hunting them. And I'm like, well, though, I'm pretty sure that laws will be enacted to protect them in that way from humans.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be against the law for us to go out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And first of all, they're not easy. It's easy to shoot one. We wouldn't be having this conversation about are mm-hmm. they, how come we haven't proven them that they exist? Well, that's because they are masters of their environment. So, we're all out there. We do go out and look for them. I know what Larry talked about. You can't force an encounter, but going out and the experiences that we've had in our research area in the Tillamook Forest, it's a matter of them if what we've had experience with are Bigfoot, it's a matter of them coming to us, not us going out and, you know, planting the fire. They're just out there, and I think it would then command some kind of extensive scientific study, probably funded by the government at that point, as to what the nature of, what their nature is and all their social. And I mean, then we'd probably get somebody could be paid to go out and actually research them in the way that Jane Goodall, Brian Fossey would have studied other primates. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's not going to be any rounding them up to, hey, you guys have to go over here to this national forest or over there because that's where your conservatory is going to be. There's just no way they're going to be able to do that. So there's going to have to be some major think tanks on this because, like Larry said, what conservatory laws are you going to put on them when they're on private property and, Billy Bob don't want you on his property, government or not, coming back here and poking around, seeing, what you got going on back there. It could get real touchy with a lot of landowners, because where I'm at, we have a lot of people that own 100, 200 or more acres of the forest, and they don't even live on that land. They just own it, been in the family for generations, et cetera, et cetera. So they're not going to really be too excited about the government saying, well, since you have these on your property, you can't build here now or something. You know what I mean? It could get ugly.
Yeah,
it could,
that's way
but
down
once
the road.
Again,
I mean, it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how do we deal with private property issues and any other species at the moment? I mean, it just depends on, again, first you have to prove that they are in that particular person's property to do anything, to enact it. It's going to be protection of the species and how that falls out, again, conservation, sure, there'll probably have to be a time of assessment, now that, we thought these things weren't real and now we know that they are and look what they are. I mean, because they're not, it's a species that's not like a gorilla, per se. It's a completely different species. So then it'll be the matter of how close are they to, to humans. I mean, there's people that believe that they're a lost tribe. So then you got a whole different issue about, do we tax them? I mean, put them on the tax roll because if they're too close. That,
right.
The way the government thinks. income stream. So yeah. So I don't know. It's a good question, Larry.
Yeah,
very
it's
good.
A great question. But I will say, the thought of mass individuals going out trying to hunt them and shoot, I think it's kind of a joke because I haven't seen. There's individuals out there that I think are actively doing that. I know there are that have had little luck, and I'm not seeing a body brought to the table yet. I don't see that many people out there. Even if they do, good luck. I've seen lots of individuals claim stuff and nothing's come into fruition. Nothing's come, no solid evidence has come from those scenarios where somebody's claimed to have shot one, whether they have or haven't. And I think in the past, it's a high possibility. But once again, where's the evidence for it? I'm not, honestly, I'm not really concerned about a bunch of individuals, as they say, rednecks going out there trying to shoot. Good luck. I mean, these are masters of their environment that have avoided man, that show glimpses every once in a while of themselves. But, even if somebody, claimed they have them on their property, there's just so little evidence for that, even though I think it's happening and it's happened in the past and it's happening now, so little evidence of that, the government, I could see just be going on, a lot of fruitless chases. There's a lot of dedicated individuals, researchers, and even some science-based individuals doing that now and coming back with little results or anything really solid to bring to the table. And just because you get science involved, I don't think they're going to have much more luck, but for a number of reasons, including I don't think there's that many Sasquatch roaming around, not in high numbers or in high concentration in areas. You know, it's a lot of times it's just a fleeting glimpse and luck of the draw. So I'm not too worried about people going out and, you know, if proven exists, them trying to hunt them. But I guarantee, you know, there will be laws passed, and it'll be a lot of knee-jerk stuff, as Larry mentioned, going on, because, you know, it's going to, even if Sasquatch has proven to exist and there's a body on the table, there's going to be a lengthy study on what Sasquatch is, and, you know, is it closer to human, is it, you know, non-human, I mean, all sorts of questions there that it'll take a lengthy amount of time to assess, like Gunnar mentioned, assess the situation, because we don't have, it's not proven, so we don't know numbers, we know nothing, so, man, what a can of worms that is as a question in all aspects.
We could do a whole show about just that. I mean, the conservation thing. One more point on that is that, you know, the difference that confirmation of the species brings is perhaps there'll be some money put behind it. That's one of the biggest challenges right now is there's nobody that is well-funded that can spend the time that it would take to actually do a thorough study. You know, that's a piece that's missing in current Bigfoot research. Now you have confirmation, and that's where I see the government or universities, you know, that now it's not taboo, that the subject is not a taboo subject, even in mainstream science. Once you have confirmation, now it can be funded to be studied, and that'll be cool. I mean, it kind of changes that. I don't think it will change the fact that obviously they're, like you say, Shane, their numbers are not tremendous, and they're not easy. They're very elusive, so it still will be a challenge for even when somebody is doing it full time. I just think that it is possible. In fact, I've said you, Shane, would be a great candidate if I had the opportunity to send Shane out in the field for an extended period of time, and he didn't have to come back until he had, you know, documentation. I think we could get something done. There's other individuals as well that, you know, if that's what they were dedicated to doing, and they didn't have, you know, have to work and have the challenges of being self-funded, I think we'd be able to document behavior and actually have clear photographs. It's a time thing and a money thing. You know, those two things are a challenge when everybody's self-funded and doing it on their own dime and their own time. So, great question, Larry.
Yeah.
I thought I'd kick you guys off with a good one.
That was a great question. Was that your only question? Are you good to go, or are you happy with that?
I think so. We could have at length discussions about this for hours, but I think between you three, the answer came through, and I hope your folks think about what in the future. What Gunnar was saying about research, further research. Oh, Shane, you'll probably be needing a wingman while you're out there.
Well, Larry, appreciate the question. I know you're up to some exciting things down there in the Oregon coast, and you had a weekend. So looking forward to having you back on, maybe chat about that sometime.
All right, we'll do.
All right,
yeah,
thanks,
thank
man.
You.
Thanks, Larry. Well, I know we had
interesting question.
We had a couple folks that had sent some questions in. You know, they weren't going to be able to make it to the live show. Shane, did you have a couple of those handy?
You know, I don't necessarily have them handy. A few of these individuals I think are going to be calling in to the show here shortly. But you know what? One of those questions, I'll tell you, it was about Washington. It came in from an individual by the name of Craig. He had a question about, you know, what was some of the more recent Sasquatch sightings in the state of Washington specifically. But I'll tell you what, we'll make that question a little more broad and say Oregon and Julie, your area of the country. You want to know what were some of the more recent encounters, and have those encounters been researched? And if they've been researched, what were some of the findings or some of the, you know, outcome of that research in those areas? And I'll start out, you know, kind of answering this question since I'm in Washington. I'll be honest with you. And part of that question was also, you know, I guess he had mentioned that the BFRO has not really updated, or there's not been a whole lot of encounters shared or sent out there from the BFRO. And he said there's been a lot in Washington State. Well, I'll be honest with you. I've not heard of a whole lot of recent encounters in the state of Washington. So things have slowed down. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I will say with the BFRO, you know, for them to post an encounter on their website, they have a private area where all these, the public doesn't get to see this, but they have an area where all these encounters, people send stuff into, you know, fresh encounters, old encounters, and then they're vetted. And by vetted, I mean for an encounter to be posted to the BFRO online, it has to be investigated by a BFRO individual investigator. So if it's not investigated, you'll never see it on the BFRO. It won't get posted. It's not just like, oh, someone shares a report and then it gets posted. No, it actually has to be physically investigated to be on the BFRO website. And so,
yeah, or to move from the private area to the public.
Can you explain a little bit more?
Sure. No, I mean, I was a BFRO investigator for a long time, and there's a private area where, like you said, raw reports come in called flats, and investigators go in and take on different reports. I'll take this one and that. But there was always a huge backlog of reports that, you know, there were never enough investigators to keep up with the reports that were coming in. So, and even if a report was investigated, didn't mean that it ever got published publicly. It just depended on, because I remember doing an investigation with David Ellis up in Washington, and it was, the report actually was a big white Bigfoot and two little ones. It was an interesting story, but supposedly there was a reference point. The report was from like 10 years prior, and there was a stump there that was supposedly the landmark that this Bigfoot walked by and where it marked it. Well, because the measurements, I can't remember, was outside of the norm. The report never got published publicly because it kind of fell out of the norm of what was, you know, there's some criteria, I guess, and I think it's kind of arbitrary. I don't know how it is now, but yeah, there was, somebody has to, you know, sometimes it's a phone call, preferably somebody goes to the location and documents it more thoroughly, but they don't just drop right into the website that people see publicly.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, guys, we have a call. Let me go ahead and grab that. Hang on just a second.
We'll wait here.
All right. Caller, you are live. May I ask who's calling us tonight?
Yeah, this is Craig Yanni from Seattle, Washington.
Oh, hey, Craig.
Awesome. Hey, Craig.
Hey, guys.
Got a question for Shane Gunner?
Yeah, well, yeah, actually, yeah, I just want to say hi to Gunner and Shane, and you guys are doing a great job on the radio here, and enjoy listening to the programs. And, yeah, I actually have three questions. It seems like you guys got one of them already. He read one off. And thanks for doing that and giving us an update on what was going on. Everybody kept asking me, and I didn't know the answer. And that was good to know, new information that I needed to know as well. Hopefully someday I'll be able to do some reports and give them in too, because I'm looking forward to getting out there and finding some good hotspot areas and updating everybody in Washington, hopefully.
Awesome. 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 Yeah.
A couple of questions. That would be, there's lots of sightings in Washington State, and I know Shane and Derek and everybody from the Olympic Project is going out quite a bit. Is there going to be any new updates on what's going on with the Olympic Project and possibly some of the other areas that are having, you know, like it's a hotspot area that they're having lots of vocalizations and possibly footprints being recorded as well?
Yeah, yeah.
Shane, you want to go ahead and take that?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, honestly, you know, it's been, it seems like there's been a little bit of a dry spell with reports coming in and encounters and whatnot. To be expected that these encounters and reports will pick up as more individuals get out there, go hiking, camping, school gets out, kids are going to be out, parents want to, you know, take advantage of that and hit the high country and the low country, whether it's on the coast or the mountains. I think your best chance right now is going to be at a higher elevation. That's just me personally, because you're going to start seeing the berries, you know, like huckleberry and Oregon grape and whatnot start to sprout. And so with there's been a lot of recent bear reports in a lot of these areas of interest in around the state of Washington and Oregon. Bears are, you know, kind of coming out of their semi-hibernation mode, and they're starting to, you know, right now we're going to see, if you find bear scat, you're going to see a lot of grass. They're feeding on grass and bark and everything else. And so as the months progress, you're going to see more and more berries in their diet. You're going to find that in the scat, but they're going to be at a higher, usually higher elevation and whatnot. And so that's where we're going to start seeing, I think, an influx in reports are from some of these higher elevation spots where people go to the mountains to go camping. You know, some of these higher mountain lakes and streams and rivers. I think that's where you can get the, you know, the gist of these reports. But there has been a lull. And I think a lot of reason for this lull, and I'll answer your question a little bit better here, Craig, but this lull, I think, has to do with the time of year. And also, you know, Finding Bigfoot, the show just ended. There was an influx in the BFRO and a multitude of other areas, other formats and whatnot, where we had a huge influx of reports. And not saying these reports are bogus and whatnot, but there was an excitement about finding Bigfoot and sharing a report. Now, the show's ended. It's publicly known that Finding Bigfoot is no more. I think there'll probably be more shows down the road. But I think because the show ended, it's kind of created this lull, an extra lull. Now, this time of year, you know, I think it's pretty predictive, you know, it's predictable that reports slow down, but they're going to pick up, I think. And I'll tell you, in Washington State, the majority of reports right now coming in from, like, Snohomish area, Snohomish counties, and Skamania, which is a well-known Bigfoot hotspot in Washington State. One mm-hmm. other area where I expect the reports to pick up, but that right now are, you know, kind of high compared to the rest of the state, is Mount Rainier, the Mount Rainier area. There's been a lot of recent track finds, a lot of recent vocalizations that have been reported. I'm not aware of too many sightings per se, but those three areas, Snohomish, Skamania, and Mount Rainier, there's been a slight influx in reports, I mean, compared to the rest of the state. Now, they'll pick up in the Olympics, in a lot of other areas, you know, Yakima and whatnot. I think they're going to pick up. But that's where the reports are coming in right now, hotter and heavier than the rest of these, some of the areas. But I also think there's a lot more people going out to some of these areas. So now, as far as to answer your question about the, pardon me, the Olympic Project, well, we're still working heavily on this nesting site, this nesting site study we've been working on with Dr. Jeff Meldrum and Todd Disattel out of New York. And we're waiting on results. I know that it's been a long – we've talked about this on the show. It's been a long process. It's a very tedious process. It's a very time-consuming, slow process. You know, we want results. We want answers, regardless of what those answers and results may come from or what they may end up being. But it's like I said, it's slow. So I expect some answers here in the next couple of weeks, quite honestly, some sort of initial results. I know Dr. Todd Distel is interested in coming out from, you know, leaving the lab and heading out towards the Olympics with us to take his own samples.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he wants to travel up this way and take his own samples. It's been a learning curve when it comes to environmental DNA and eDNA. It's been a learning curve for him, for us. You know, he's an expert in his field, but you know, with eDNA, it's been around for years, but it's still, there's a lot of kinks to be worked out. There's a lot to learn. There's new techniques being revealed daily in how to collect stuff and how to analyze it via eDNA. And so he wants to personally come out and collect his own samples under some of these new guidelines that he's learned delving into eDNA. I think we should have some initial results or some sort of results here shortly. I don't know for a fact. I'm guessing, being, you know, talking back and forth with these individuals involved, and we'll see what happens. I can't make any promises, and chances are it probably won't be shared online, you know, because it's science. It's beyond me, so it's science, and it needs to be vetted, peer-reviewed, blah, 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 before anything substantial is shared publicly. You know, it's just the way it works, and that's, you know, we're very much about that. But I will tell you this. I will tell you this, Craig. You know, not too far away from the nest site, we have found recently in an adjacent area, not too far away, we found recent tracks that we were pretty enthralled with, pretty intrigued with, and we found these recent tracks and casted them, smaller tracks, larger tracks, and this area still to this day, we do get reports in from time to time, you know, periodically, but there have been some recent interesting track impressions found in an adjacent area that gives me hope. In fact, Cliff Berrickman and I, not too far away, investigated a report of a sighting. This is the one sighting that I know of recently where Cliff Berrickman of, you know, Finding Bigfoot and a good friend of mine, he and I went out to this area to investigate a recent sighting from a young individual that had pulled over alongside a creek, was tossing rocks in the creek, and he knows that there was more rocks coming into the creek than he was throwing, and when he had stopped, these rocks kept coming in, and he looks up from the other side of the creek, and he sees a large, hairy individual, a large, hairy something, and it was down on all fours, as he described it. And when it stood up, he said it was massive, and it took off.
Wow.
Yeah, it took off. And so that was something we investigated. We found a couple of interesting impressions. We found some kind of interesting scat, but we didn't really find anything more than that. And we spent quite a few hours in this area combing it, hiking it, looking around. But everything that this individual had mentioned kind of matched up. I mean, we could see where he had pulled over, found his tire tracks. It looked like at the time he had gotten the heck out of there really quick because there was a large peel out in the sand next to this creek, which was really interesting. And then when I you know, looked at this area, it made a lot of sense for me given that the nest site wasn't too – I mean, it was a distance, but it wasn't extremely far away. But this area was very interesting because of the location and the food sources and the crossing area that it might have taken to get to another area. And not to mention there's been other reports historically in this area. And I can't mention the area, but it just got a lot going for it. And so this time of year, though, I'll tell you what, in this area that we're working on, the nest site, things seem to activity, reports, vocalizations, you name it, die down because I think of the elevation. I think Sasquatch personally, I think it moves up into these higher elevated spots where there's abundance of berries and whatnot. You know, I could be wrong. I don't know. But that's just to give you a lengthy answer to your question, Craig. That's kind of, you know, Washington State, the reports are going to pick up, I think. I really do believe that as people get out. And there'll be a lot of, you know, misidentifications and whatnot. You really got to pay attention to the nuggets in some of the sightings to really peel out what's a misidentified identified sighting, you know, a bear or a person or whatever, to what's possibly got some gold nuggets in there, and maybe there's some activity of the Sasquatch nature. So I hope that kind of answers your question.
Oh, it does. Thanks, Shane. Yeah, that was great. Yeah, it seems to me that the Sasquatch and Bigfoot are moving up higher to the berries. And I know when I went out this weekend a little bit, I saw salmon berries everywhere. And that's the good indication that things are starting to bloom and berries are budding out and everything is moving around. One quick question. This will be the last one. And as far as the Sasquatch family and clans go, and with the Bigfoot and Sasquatch, for the years and years of camera work that I've been doing at all the conferences, and I've been pretty quiet about it. I don't talk a lot about it, but I do have some of my own opinions and stuff. And I do really like what Derek's doing and you're doing and Dr. Jeff Meldrum and some of the other Sasquatch researchers. And it seems to me that when they go out, they know the areas where the activity is happening, because my personal opinion is that I think that they're staying within a certain area, but they do migrate around, but they do kind of like hang out in ponds and rivers and areas where there's lots of food, and they do kind of follow that food chain. But it doesn't seem to me like they're traveling thousands of miles. Maybe they're traveling at the most hundreds of miles, but if they do have families, they need to feed their kids and their families, and then they kind of migrate around. And every now and then, I'm sure you get some gypsy travelers who are going long distances. But do you think that is kind of close to what a lot of researchers are thinking, or do you think they migrate like big giant elk herds and deer herds, and they're just going major distances? What's the take on that?
Yeah, I'll let Gunner and Julie jump in on this in a sec, but I do have I personally am of the opinion that Sasquatch doesn't need to travel hundreds of miles to survive and thrive. In fact, mm-hmm. In the Olympics, one of the areas that we research, you know, there's a herd of elk about 40 strong that don't travel hundreds of miles. They travel many square miles, but they go from higher to lower elevation. In fact, they're on the property this time of year eating the grass around where we camp and our hub is, but they don't, we'll find them in higher elevations, the same herd, but not necessarily hundreds of miles away. They don't need to necessarily travel. You know, they're following food sources. And I think Sasquatch is the same, whether they hunt deer or elk or eat, you know, berries and whatnot. It really revolves around a couple of key things here. It's food, you know, natural resources. I think definitely it's also about humans. You know, where are we at? If there's a lot of humans in one area, not that they won't come in and out in an area, but they're not going to survive and thrive there. They would have been found. And the weather, of course, the weather obviously plays a huge role. You know, if you got a snow elevation, well, there's not much food up there, you know, so you're going to travel lower and lower, you know, in the winter, and then higher, at least here in the Pacific Northwest. You know, as the snow comes down, you know, the peaks get insurpassable and a lot of snow, and you travel down and down and down. And I think that's why you see more reports on the coastal ranges in the winter, you know, where you got plenty, you know, you got salmon coming up the rivers, you have mussels and all sorts of stuff, you know, and of course, ungulates traveling around deer and whatnot to eat and eat upon. But, you know, definitely, I think they don't have to travel many miles. It's just about where are those natural resources and where can they survive and thrive. And in the Olympics, I think for me, it's a perfect example. Is when we see reports, you know, the Olympics is really cool because it's surrounded by coastal areas. You know, it's a giant, huge peninsula, basically. And
lots
you can go
food.
From
yeah.
mountain to, yeah, you can go from mountain to coast in no time. And get out of, you can go from really cold, snowy weather to, you know, temperate rainforest sort of scenarios where there's abundance of plant life and animal life and fish life and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, I think, and I think as a whole, I think a lot of individuals, researchers have come to the realization that Sasquatch or animals in general don't have to travel these hundreds of miles of migrated area to migrate. That they can actually just travel relatively small distances to survive and thrive. Now, there's a lot of people who disagree with me that think Sasquatch travels great distances. And you know what? They could be right. I don't think so. Just my opinion. Gunnar, what do you think?
I think they're transitory, not migratory. I think it's all about resources,
right.
food and water and cover. That,
yeah.
You know, no animal is going to expend more energy than they need to survive. So they're going to, you know, if they have enough food, they have enough cover, and they have enough water, they're going to work a range, you know, just like any other known animal does. That's my opinion.
Absolutely. I agree, Gunnar. Yeah.
Yeah. Julie, what about you? Do you have an opinion on this? Did we lose Julie?
No, I'm sorry. I'm here. I had my mute on. Hello?
Yeah. Julie.
What's your opinion, Julie, on Sasquatch migrating, you know, huge distances and whatnot? I mean, do you think that's a possibility, or do you think they don't need to migrate huge distances? You know, being on the East Coast side of things, what's your opinion?
Well, I know that on the west side of North Carolina is the Appalachian Mountains, and they may go from higher levels to lower levels depending on season and food supply and weather and, you know, things that you guys are talking about, because they have that ability to do that. But where I'm at in central North Carolina, there's really not those mountains, so to speak. We have some that, you know, are maybe 1,200 feet tall, the maximum. So I don't think that they're needing to migrate anywhere in that area. And I can tell you that I am a few miles away from the Uari. And it appears that they're there, around there. And I just don't see them going very far, because they may not have to go very far. Everything they need is right there. You know, thousands of acres of forest and ponds and lakes and everything. So they may transit it and maybe kind of go a pattern, if you will. Because it seems like they do have sort of a pattern where they go around the area that I'm at. So I think they just kind of follow the food, but they always have to stay close by that water source.
Yeah, that's for sure. Definitely. And then one more quick question, guys.
Yeah.
The other one is that, and I'm thinking that there's a possibility that they're caving, like, you know, they find a cave and they're caving in these caves, you know, temporarily and moving around, following the food sources and drinking water and making families and whatnot. But also the nests are being found, and those could be gypsy stationary areas where they're gypsying around, trying to get to different locations to find food. And these are where trackways can be found. You know, if you're out there quite a bit in one area, you kind of get used to seeing certain things. And my thoughts are that they are possibly doing a little bit of both, nesting and caving. And this is one of the reasons why that a lot of people aren't getting the individual real sightings. They're getting vocalizations, and these are areas where the vocalizations are bouncing around in the mountain areas, and they're up high, moving up high to get out of the way of the people when the summers come. And then when, you know, the food sources are needed to be for their families, they get in there and feed real quick and then get out. But as far as, you know, your guys' take on whether they're in the caves or just hiding in the forest or in the mountains, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'll take this one off the bat. You know, it's interesting because there's different cave systems around the country. I mean, you look at Mount St. Helens, it has a different cave system. You have areas on the East Coast and whatnot that have different cave systems. Does, you know, a lot of animals utilize caves? I know in the Olympics, for example, we have found large rock formations that kind of make a cave system. And we've gotten some interesting results around that area, both with Sasquatch and cougar and everything else. They utilize these areas for shelter, and whatnot. I'll be honest with you, I haven't personally found a lot of evidence, at least in the Pacific Northwest or the Olympics, for example, to say that Sasquatch really uses a lot of cave systems. I know a number of years ago in the Mount Hood National Forest area, there were a few reports of people coming across like a nest in kind of a cave system. I kind of know the general idea of the area, and it's not a huge cave system. It's very small, where somebody came across a nest and some, I believe it was, it was some sort of plant life, farming, like Brussels sprouts or something like that, where it looked like the nearest farming area for that sort of plant was like 10 miles away, and they found it in this cave system, and they smelt some weird stuff. They found a nest in this area, and it looks like something had transported that farmer's product to this area, and something was maybe utilizing this caving system, and it wasn't much of a caving system. But like I said, I'll be honest, I haven't found a whole lot of evidence of Sasquatch utilizing cave systems. We had some interesting results in the Olympics where there's been these large rock formations that kind of, you know, make up a cave system, where we found impressions and heard some interesting vocalizations and whatnot nearby. But, you know,
like
the,
an outcropping.
Yeah, an outcrop, exactly, like an outcropping, not a pure cave system per se.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know what, from time to time, Sasquatch probably does utilize those, cats and bears and a lot of animals do. But with the Pacific Northwest, I mean, up here we have so much we have such an abundance of trees and forests in areas that are so thick it's hard to get into or almost impossible to get into. This nesting area that we're working on, for example, there's not a cave system remotely close to this area. There's not even a rock formation or outcropping remotely close to this area. And I'm not saying, like I said before, I'm not screaming that Sasquatch made these nests, but I think it's a very high probability given the area and the resources and the structure and everything else. But, you know, they probably use them from time to time, but they have such a vast resource of things. You know, I mean, you go out in the woods, and that's why they call hunting. I mean, it's not easy when you go out hunting deer or elk per se, you know, unless you're on some sort of preserve or something. It's an art. And I think Sasquatch, it's just a master of its environment, where it utilizes the high areas. You know, I've preached this because this is something I fundamentally believe in when it comes to Sasquatch, is they always, always, always take advantage of the high areas, of high formations, structures, and mountains and whatnot. And that's why they can monitor us and we don't have no idea. I think they always, every thing that I've ever had happen to me that I may find suspicious or intriguing or that I attribute possibly to Sasquatch has come from an area where they've had the high ground. And I think that's their advantage over us, is, you know, a lot of these sightings and reports that we've investigated over the years, Gunner and I and the Lynn Project, Sasquatch is seen going up a hill, or it's on a hill, or it's in that. They have the high ground. That's their advantage. When they're caught
there's
in the low
on
ground,
the hill.
There's something on the hill. Yeah. Well, I think that's where the advantage is. I think truly that's where the advantage is. So, yeah, do they utilize those things? Possibly. We've had some interesting things happen around some of these outcroppings, as you said, Craig, which is correct. But I've never found a whole, you know, subterranean stuff I've heard about in cave systems. Yeah, but you know what? If you're in a cave system, if there's no out, you're kind of screwed in a lot of ways.
That makes sense.
And not that there's not an out, but in a lot of scenarios that I've investigated over the years, there is no out. And once you're trapping yourself, and I don't think Sasquatch needs to partake in living in these cave systems. I think they do, just like bear and everything else, they can do quite well out in the natural environment because they're just, you know, absolute perfectionists when it comes to living out there beyond what we can even fathom. So, that's just my two cents.
Well, I think that's great. That's a great answer. Thank you, guys. I just want to say
great.
thanks to Gunner and everybody. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Craig. Thank you so much.
Okay, and I'll just...
So, fantastic question there. Fantastic question there from Craig. I really enjoyed those questions. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, sir. And I look forward to meeting you. I know we've talked periodically, and I know you're up to great things, and your background and profession I'm well aware of, and I'm looking forward to collaborating with you down the road for sure. We have another caller. Are we going to take this caller? Yeah.
Yeah, let me go ahead and get them on here. Hold on.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, caller, you are live. Who are we speaking with?
Hello?
Hello? 253.
Hey,
you're live
Todd
on Stretch Radio. Hey, Todd.
How you guys doing?
Doing good, man.
Doing pretty good. I'm assuming you recovered from your trip to the nest site.
Took a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
That was a good one. I don't know if you wanted to talk about vocalizations. Have you guys ever heard anything remotely close to Sierra sounds or otherwise? That's basically my question. That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Gunner, do you want to take that one right off the bat?
Sure. The closest thing that I've heard is the first time that I went out to what became our research area in the Tillamook Forest. And if you've heard the story, we had all these vocalizations going on. First time I met my good friend Larry, Cindy Goodell had taken us out there. And, you know, this went on for like 2 hours, whoops. And what you would put as classic kind of Bigfoot vocalizations of whoops and yells, and it was really weird. And then it culminated about midnight with all this like weird lot of chatter, and the interesting thing was, because I was actually listening through a headset with a bionic mic, I thought that I heard something that sounded like that chatter. And underneath this, like, other vocalizations going on, it was really weird. And I actually took the headset off, tossed it so I could hear it. And because my mind immediately went to, because all the time I'm analyzing it, could it be people? Could it be people? Why wouldn't it be people? And it wasn't, I just didn't think it would be people considering what we were hearing. But there was some kind of, my brain immediately went to, well, maybe it is people, because I was trying to strain to hear words that I recognized, and I did, and it was some kind of weird, and it wasn't for very long, but I heard it in this other noise, and Larry and I both looked at each other when it was all over, and like, because Larry had said something about one of these days, I really want to hear samurai chatter, and there was something, you know, not as clear as what Ron Moorhead is recording from Sierra Sounds, but it was interesting. And yeah, I never heard anything like it any other time. But was it Bigfoot?
Interesting.
I don't know. Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
That one was weird. And we've had a lot of weird stuff happen up there.
Yeah, we have. And I personally, Todd, I'm never heard anything in person, or actually never recorded, after thousands of hours of recordings, never recorded anything like what was recorded with the Sierra Sounds. But we're going to have a guest on. We're going to be recording a show down the road here next week, actually, with an individual here in Washington State that has some audio that is very it's short, but it's very reminiscent of the Sierra Sounds. It's much smaller recording. It's not the same length and whatnot, but it's very reminiscent of the Sierra Sounds that Ron Moorhead got. Very reminiscent. And I'm excited about this interview that we're going to be recording next week, because it's ongoing. It's been happening for a couple of years now. And it's going to be kind of a Monster X exclusive sort of interview. And I'm excited for a number of reasons, because it's David Ellis of the Olympic Project is heavily involved in this encounter or encounters or whatnot. And they do have a couple of snippets that are very reminiscent, like I said, of the Sierra sounds. But there's also a whole lot of stuff going on with this encounter over several years. And so we will be including some of that audio in this interview, and you can look forward to it, and it will be a public, you know, it will be there for the public, but it's exciting. And like I said, I've never heard anything even close to what Ron recorded. And so his recordings are bar none interesting to all get out, because I've never heard anything like that. I've heard, you know, heard and recorded grunts and whistles and a lot of weird stuff over the years. I know, Todd, we're going to have you on the show at some point, Todd, because I know you we are, because you have an amazing story to tell yourself that I think needs to be out there. But I've never personally heard that sort of chatter. I've always, I've been in some areas where I thought, if there's going to be chatter and I've had stuff going on, this is where it's going to happen. I've never recorded it, never heard it. But next, right, you know, next week, we're going to be sharing some stuff down the road here where an individual, I think, has recorded something very similar. In fact, when Ron Moorhead heard, and he's heard this individual's recordings, he thought they were his own recordings at the time. And they weren't. They were someone else's. What? And so that's very intriguing. It's collaboration. It's possibly mimicking what he recorded, and so that's very exciting to me. Todd, obviously, have you ever heard anything like that? I know you're an Olympic Project member and whatnot. You're a solid individual. Have you ever heard anything like that, like the Ron Moorhead recordings?
Not exactly like that, but I have heard some strange things, whispering and mumbling, you know, things like that. But no, not me personally. We've been yelled at, things like that, but not like Sierra sounds. I was just curious. I have heard other recordings from other states that sound exactly like Ron Moorhead's, though.
Okay. You know? Well, we're going to have you on the show, man. I know it's been at times a bit of a arm twisting, but I wanted you on the show because you got incredible insight into a lot of stuff. You have incredible. You've been involved with some of the best Bigfoot researchers that I know. We're going to be doing some stuff this year I'm excited about. So, we're going to have you on the show, man, for sure. Look forward to having Todd Hill on the show. I'm looking forward to it.
You heard it here first. Exclusive.
Yeah. Exclusive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Well,
right
that's
on, man.
Well, I mean, it's. I won't steal Todd's thunder, but, I mean, there's a Bigfoot term video that Todd has some insights in that haven't been shared a lot, so it's cool that we'll have him here.
Oh yeah, very cool.
When we can pin him down.
Very busy. Very busy. We're gonna get you on, man, shortly. But thanks for your question. You got any more questions, or was that it?
No, that was basically it. I was just listening, just kicking back on my one day off until next week.
Yeah.
And I guess I'll see you guys next weekend.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks,
see you next
Todd,
weekend,
for calling in.
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, you know what? I mean, he's one of my favorite peeps. I mean, he's just an amazing individual. Todd Hill's a go-getter. He gets out there. He's about as honest as all can be. And, man, I'll tell you what, I'm glad he called in, because I can't wait to get him on the show, having worked with certain thermal footage pieces out there, been involved. He's got so much insight, having traveled from California to Washington. He's been around for many years under the radar and involved in a lot of cool stuff. So he's going to be a cool individual to talk with. And he has agreed to join us on Monster X Radio, and I'm excited about that. So it's going to be a fun thing.
Yeah, no, it's Todd. When I was able to go out with Todd to the nest site with Shane and Chris Spencer and Rebecca Slick, and it was we had a good time. And I got to know Todd. I'd met Todd before, but that was really a lot of fun. He's a kick in the pants. So I think we've actually run over our normally allotted time for the show, but that we just couldn't stop. And I know there was another caller or two, and we'll have to do this again.
Yeah.
We'll schedule another one. We were kind of trying this out to see how it would go. One of the things, we didn't want to deal with a bunch of trolls calling in. You get that sometimes when you do a live show. Quite a while back, we did. You know, we were doing live shows all the time, and we had a couple of Yahoo
right.
call in, and it was entertaining actually. But we to get it under control. So
yeah, the live shows are tough because you have to deal with. We don't have like a 5 second delay here on Blog Talk. It's very much a live format, and we've dealt with this in the past. This was kind of a gamble. And it worked out great tonight. We had some really interesting questions, some that I hope I answered as best as I could. But overall, I think it went really well. Like I said, we had a couple callers in the queue, and we unfortunately can't take those callers. But so much to talk about. We need to do this again real soon, Gunner.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun because I like talking to my friends about Bigfoot and having some of them call in and it's just like sitting around the campfire and BSing about the subject, you know, and everything is pretty much a vast majority of what we're talking about with the subject is speculation and opinion. I mean, we don't know, you know, we don't have answers. We have more questions than answers. So we really appreciate the folks that took the time to call in, and I know I'm sorry to the folks that didn't get a chance to come on air, but we will do this again soon. I think it was a good show to do, and we look forward to talking to those that didn't get their questions answered. So I think with that, we're going to wrap this up. I want to thank my co-host Julie Wrench and Mr. Shane Hardcore Corson for joining me today here on Monster X. Until next week, have a great week, and go out and find a Bigfoot.
Yes.
There's something outside.
What is that?
Radio.